Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we have to, for our appeals to heaven to be more effective, we have to continue learning, praying, and acting, because we want to be equally effective in how we're responding, because we have a responsibility in our self-government, folks. It's all about compliance to the Constitution. That's simple. We have to demand every public servant fulfill their oath in fully supporting the Constitution, and we have to oppose every infraction against that Constitution. Not my words, those are Madison's words. So the point is that if we can put aside our differences and unite on demanding compliance to the Constitution, all of our problems would go away. There's no money in this, and so that's one of the reasons why we really have a hard time getting people to flip over. Because, you know, they'd rather not pay taxes. They'd rather, you know, be a part of an organization that, you know, they've been convinced that, oh, this organization is going to do it. But nobody challenges by actually saying, show me a model of how what you're going to do is going to solve all of our problems. And 9 times out of 10, they're not trying to solve all the problems. They're only trying to solve one specific problem. They're okay with the rest of the violations. And as long as you're okay with that, then we've got a problem. This is why I said just a minute ago, we have to oppose every violation, not just the one that these myopic organizations are highlighting. All that being said, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you. All right, good to be here.
Thank you. And it's time to conclude on South Carolina. We got literally just a portion of a paragraph to read. We couldn't get it done yesterday. So we got to drag South Carolina across the finish line here. And folks, I don't have the analysis, but if you want to, they actually, at the end of each of the ratification debates, they show how they vote. And you'll notice that most all of the states have their delegations and everything organized by county. And yet, today, the Supreme Court says the county means nothing. Anyway. All right. So let's go ahead and read this last nugget, and then we will get started with the Virginia ratification debates.
All right. But above all, how much will this section tend to restore your credit with foreigners, to rescue your national character from that contempt which must ever follow the most flagrant violations of public faith and private honesty? No more shall paper money, no more shall tender laws, drive their commerce from our shores, and darken the American name in every country where it is known. No more shall our citizens conceal in their coffers those treasures which the weakness and dishonesty of our government have long hidden from the public eye. The firmness of a just and even system shall bring them into circulation, and honor the virtue shall be again known and countenanced among us. No more shall the widow, the orphan, and the stranger become the miserable victims of unjust rulers. Your government shall now indeed be a government of laws.
There you go. And that's the whole point of what a republican form of government is. One, there's two points, right? There is, it's a nation of laws, and the Constitution being the supreme law. The other is a republican form of government is one of representation. And what is our representation? Or who are we representing? Who is represented in the government? Not we the people, the sovereigns. Got to get that in your head, folks. Not just we the people as sovereigns, the governments that we the people create and the sovereignty we delegated to them is equally represented. It's represented in the county. It should have been, and it was, until the Supreme Court basically played with it. And they basically pushed us closer to ruin by making us more of a democracy, wiping out our republican, constitutional, republican forms of government. Most of the Western states had constitutions that actually identified apportionment for the counties. This is not uncommon. So what the Supreme Court ended up doing by mandating districts and apportioning everybody by population, wiping out the counties, was literally an egregious violation of the Constitution. So that pretty much wraps up the South Carolina debates. And so what we now get to do, and actually I'll just say this, the Virginia ratification debates happen to be my favorite. Now, they're the longest. I think that they're the most voluminous, I believe. They're 433 pages. Not light reading. And actually, because it is so long and because there's just so much to it, we've, you know, highlighted stuff that, and there's a lot to go through. This is probably going to take several weeks just because there's that much meat in here. Because these men understood the government's insides and outs, and they were trying to nitpick Patrick Henry and his ilk that wanted to protect the power base of Virginia, the little power cabal that they had, and they did not want to share their power with a general government and make a general government basically competent, and instead they would prefer an impotent general government. So, as we kind of look at the Virginia ratification debates, you're looking at them? You got them?
I am.
Okay. Yep. So the very first thing that we kind of start off with is, and they actually don't add this to the debates. They do not add the challenging of the formal challenging of the ratification process. The anti-federalists felt that they would just basically say, we're not doing this. This was a violation. They forced the issue for the delegates of Virginia to determine whether the commission was violated or not. Because had the anti-federalists had their way, they would go home. And the ratification of the Constitution never would have happened in Virginia. And so, I guess, you know, many of the men, or the majority of those men that were there, said, no, they didn't violate the commission. So they handled it in a democratic process. Academically, it was argued as such that they did have, and actually, when I look at the people that try to support the idea that the convention was a runaway convention, in other words, a runaway means that they completely abandoned their responsibility. That's what a runaway is. And so by the definition, they actually held tightly to their commissions. And that's why they kept on bringing up their commissions. Not that the fact that they were violating, but just to make sure that they were in line with it. So, as we kind of dive into the Virginia debates, we don't see the fact that, you know, they already took care of that problem. It wasn't included because the document that we have is the document of the ratification process. It was a self-contained document. So as they dive into this, and they dive in on June 3rd, but June 4th is when some of the real oration gets heavy, because they've basically set up their procedures, you know, and what the process is. So now what we actually have, and we start off with Mr. Nicholas, George Nicholas of, actually, he's in a county that actually becomes Kentucky. And so George Nicholas basically starts dealing with an argument that was created by the gentleman before him, Mr. Patrick Henry. And so Mr. Patrick Henry basically was doing everything. Like I said, this guy was trying to kill the Constitution. Everybody loves Patrick Henry because he was a rebel, you know, the lion. And, you know, give me liberty or give me death. And so, unfortunately, in this part of history, Patrick Henry was on the wrong side of the law, on liberty. He wanted to actually allow the states to maintain their controls. And so, anyway, let's find out what Mr. Nicholas has to say regarding jurisdiction.
All right. It is objected, however, as a defect in the Constitution that it does not prohibit the House of Representatives from getting their powers, particularly that respecting the support and etc. of the armies out of the hands for a longer term than 2 years. Here, I think the enemies to the plan reason unfairly. They first suppose that Congress, from a love of power natural to all, will in general abuse that with which they are invested, and then they would make us apprehend that the House of Representatives, notwithstanding their love of power, and it must be supposed as great in a branch of Congress as in the whole, will give out their hands the only check which can ensure to them the continuance of participation of the powers lodged in Congress in general. In England, there is no restraint of this kind on the Parliament, and yet there is no instance of money bill being passed for a longer term than 1 year. The proposed plan, therefore, when it declares that no appropriation for the support of any army shall be made for a longer term than 2 years, introduces a check unknown to the English Constitution, and one which will be found very powerful when we reflect that if the House of Representatives could be prevailed on to make an appropriation for an army for 2 years, at the end of that time there will be a new choice of representatives.
Okay, hold on. Okay. I wanted to kind of get through to a point. So, when he's talking about appropriations for an army, that means that they have to pay these men to come into the federal service. They will receive a compensation. So there's an appropriation for the army under federal control. That appropriation is different than the appropriation for actually funding the militia at the state level. Remember, folks, that the federal government has the constitutional responsibility to both organize, and discipline the militia. They're paying for this. So they have to have an apportionment of giving and making sure that every person has the same kind of arms. In other words, Colt 45s today. Do we go to the Beretta 9mm? They want to make sure that if your gun breaks, if something happens, that there will be replacement parts that they can, because it's about maintaining this continuity and standards. That's the whole point of giving the federal government the ability to do this, because it would be, just imagine how crazy it would be if everybody showed up with what they wanted to use. That's like a bunch of Boy Scouts at a camporee. This is not something to be a novel concept. This is not something to be, you know, trifling. The federal government for, you know, putting our men in harm's way, we want to make sure that they are 100% prepared. So the Constitution has an apportionment that they actually have to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. Not necessarily whether they're in the service or not. They have to be prepared to be called up to service with what they need. You don't wait till they actually show up. You don't wait until, okay, we're going to federalize you. Now we're going to decide what guns we're going to use. They had a responsibility up front of funding that. So when they finally federalize them, they cannot budget anything that would span a two-year period. Ergo, when the army is put into the federal service, they must be sent back and put back into the state federal or back into the state service before they can call them up again. The reality is the only time that they would actually be able to maintain the army is if we're in war. Now, what does that mean? Well, look at the whole cause of calling forth the militia. They have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections and repel invasions. So if they're going to enforce the laws of the Union and they have a problem of doing it more than 2 years, then they need to actually start sending back parts of the militia and calling forth other parts of the militia to kind of do that if it's going to be a permanent enforcement. But technically what they did was they worked out a mechanism where federal marshals would work with the counties so that the states had to enforce the laws. The marshals couldn't knock down doors and take your money. They had to work with the sheriffs. They had to work with the state authorities. So that was the whole intent of this. So the concept of using the federalized militia into the army, because when we say the army, that means the militia has been federalized. You don't call it the militia anymore. It is the federal army. But what's the source of those? It is the militia, because they're all prepared. They're all coming up with their guns. They're coming up with everything they need to know and are ready to go to war. But they don't pay for that other than those fundamental things, like I said. So the federal government has a responsibility of maintaining the militia. Now, as they call them forward for executing the laws, that doesn't they couldn't fathom it would take more than 2 years to do that. So the suppressing the insurrection is the only other thing. If there are people within the states that are basically insurrecting, they're not going along with federal laws. They're basically revolting. Then they have the authority to call forth the militia and go in and suppress the insurrection. The only other thing that the federal government can federalize the militia for is for it fighting an invasion. So when we talk about war, they declare war. They declare war on the invaders. If they don't like something that's happening somewhere overseas, do they have the authority to call forth a militia and deploy them overseas? No. They can declare war overseas, but they cannot use the militia. The militia was designed to protect the homeland. The army was never to be deployed. It was only to protect the homeland. So the Navy is where they can actually go and fight wars abroad. And the Navy and the Marine Corps is where the only constitutional standing for fighting the wars. But when it comes to the militia, they can only be in service for 2 years. How long can the Navy be in service?
Forever.
They're to be maintained. There's no funding limit. In other words, they are the strategic defense.
Right.
Okay. So most people, when they're looking at what the armed forces is doing, none of it's right. Nobody is actually following the Constitution because they've made it up as they've gone along. And it's such a, excuse the expression, it's such a bastardization of the Constitution that everybody wants to argue these stupid little minutia points when none of them are valid. Anyway, all right, so back to Mr.
So what about the things like Trump just did with the bombings?
So this goes down to the question of, was America's interest being preserved or protected? Does the President of the United States have the ability to use deadly force to protect lives? Absolutely. So he exercised those powers to do that. Congress has a right to challenge him and basically say, okay, come before us, because it's not like he declared war. He didn't declare war. He just took executive action. Technically, when we look at historically executive action was not using the militia, you know, by what he was using. Technically, when we look at the Air Force and the Army and the way they have been, you know, created and maintained today, it's a complete abomination. Now, had he used, and we only had, if we did it right, and this was a Navy strike, that would have been a legitimate strike. But using the Army and the Air Force, that's not legitimate. I mean, I'm just trying to really get to the accurate what should have happened and what could he do. He has the power to use the Navy to basically execute a protective measure if he felt imminent danger was coming. And so he made that decision. Now he can go defend that in front of Congress, because it's not like he declared war. They just want to make sure that he didn't create a situation that we would be at war. And are we at war? No. I mean, Reagan went into Grenada. Thomas Jefferson went into Tripoli to fight the Barbary pirates, to basically, you know, go fight the Barbary pirates, get our ship back, get our goods back, and get our sailors back. And that's exactly what the Marines did. Mm-hmm. So was Thomas Jefferson within his powers? Historically, yes. But the problem was with, and this all started with George Washington. George Washington, being an army man, liked and gave favor for the Department of War to be controlled by a ground forces general instead of an admiral. When really the only, so technically, that ground forces general should not even be in the War Department if they don't have the militia. So who should be in the War Department? It should have been an admiral, because that's the one that would have continuity that they would always maintain in service. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, see, it does. So as we start looking at what should have happened, but who's going to challenge George Washington? This is what George Washington wanted, so nobody wanted to challenge the big man. I mean, he saved our butts, and they loved him, and he was beloved. And it's not like he was trying to do really bad things, but bottom line, they weren't following the Constitution. And his appointment, they actually should have challenged the Senate. See, that's what they didn't do, because they had to be nice. Had the Senate basically said, why are you putting General Knox as the Secretary of War instead of an admiral? Because clearly the Navy needs to be created now. We don't need to have a federalized army now in 1789.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so the constant justification and the worm-tonguing and the soothsaying of why they needed to constantly maintain, and they became very good at bolstering the army for maintaining the cavalry in the West, for doing this. I mean, when you let people, you know, when you come along, you know, to a territory and say, hey, we're going to put the cavalry out there to protect you. Oh, well, yeah, that'd be great. Then I don't have to worry about it, and I can do what I need to do. And that's what those guys do. They go fight Indians or whatever, right? So people, 9 times out of 10, will never look a gift horse in the mouth. But if the people really understood whether the federal government should be doing that or not, and whether the people in that territory should be preparing to become a part of a militia, so that when that state stands up, the militia will be able to function.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, but yeah. They never did that. The army downplayed the militia as the West was expanding. No, no, we're going to fight your wars for you. You don't need to do that. And so the army was constantly being maintained. Because, and if you really look at when they started going west, you know, and expanding into the territories with the new Louisiana Territory and the other aggressive actions that America was making to basically do this end sea-to-sea nation, the contiguous 48 states that we call them, well, they were maintaining an army throughout all of that, and nobody batted an eye. So, anyway, the bottom line is, that was not within the framework of the Constitution. And when the Federalist paper, when the Anti-Federalist said that that's what they're going to do, that didn't mean it was constitutional. The reality is it was never constitutional what they were doing. But nobody challenged it. You know, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison challenged the Alien Sedition Acts. How come there weren't other ardent, you know, constitutionalists were challenging all these other things, like the cavalry being maintained out in the West, instead of the state standing up their own militias and taking care of their own business.
See how that would have been tempting for them to do, though, which is accept it.
Correct. Now, we don't have much time to go forward, so we can pick it back up where, you know, you left off after the break. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, don't even realize that when a state joined the Union, the forts, everything that was in the boundary of that state becomes state property. If the states, because they're supposed to have their own militia, if they want to use those forts for their militia, then there they go. They've got them. But if they don't, and they say, you know, the Army, you know, we'll be happy to keep that, technically, the federal government would have to pay for that fort now, even though they built it and paid for it in the initial. For them to maintain it, they would actually have to pay for that land to make it federal land in that state. They couldn't create federal land and maintain that. Because once the state, then the state actually has the control of whether they want to use that for their own militia or whether they want to keep the army there. The state has full control. Anyway, running out of time. We'll be right back after this quick promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we kind of move forward, Nicholas is actually going to point on some other things. He's going to kind of point out, you know, this concept of the regional provincial governments, the counties and so forth, and the kind of pointing to these responsibilities. So go ahead. Both of the political, militia, so forth, but go ahead. Oh, so, folks, Tammy can't go ahead right now because I've locked down the microphone, but I've now unlocked it, so go ahead. You're free now.
Okay. Thus, I insist that security does not depend on the number of representatives. The experience of that country also shows that many of their counties and cities contain a greater number of souls that will be entitled to representation in America, and yet the representatives chosen in those places have been the most strenuous advocates of liberty and have exerted themselves in the defense of it, even in opposition to those chosen by much smaller numbers. Many of the senatorial districts in Virginia also contain a greater number of souls, and yet I suppose no gentleman within these walls will pay the senators chosen by them so poor a compliment as to attribute less wisdom and virtue to them than to the delegates chosen from single counties. And as there is greater probability that the electors in a large district will be more independent, so I think the representatives chosen in such districts will be more so too. For those who have sold themselves to their representatives will have no right to complain if they in their turn barter away their rights and liberties, but those who have not themselves been bought will never consent to be sold. Another objection made to the small number of representatives is that admitting they were sufficient to secure their integrity, yet they cannot be acquainted with the local situation and circumstances of their constituents. When we attend to the object of their jurisdiction, we find this objection insupportable. Congress will superintend the great national interests of the Union. Local concerns are left to the state legislators.
So that's the division right there. So Congress is only concerned with the national stuff. So they're going to kind of be looking at Britain to the east, or to the west, I mean. Right? I mean, now the nation's forming. Mm-hmm. What was the need? Let me just go on this little break here. What was the need for the militia in the, you know, the beginning of this new republic? Did they need more militia concerns? And so what they had to do was they needed to make sure that the states were prepared. Because at this point in time, we weren't under any attack. There was no invasion. So they didn't have a need for calling forth militia. But they did have a need to standing up the Navy and creating coastal defenses. But why did Washington not do that? He was focused more on land forces and building up a defense from the interior, from the north, and from the south. So this was the problem. Even though Washington was the leader that made America come together, he had a paradigm of a ground force man. He was a foot soldier. He was not a sailor. He looked strategically on the field of battle, but not in the art of war. And I think if you really look, how much did Washington really control the Continental Forces, i.e. the Navy and the Marine Corps? I honestly don't think that he was really calling the shots. I think that, there was more autonomy between them because they didn't have the ability for real-time governing and real-time warfare. Washington was really focused on what was happening on the ground. It was nice to know, and who was really fighting our war on the sea? It really wasn't the Navy, because the Marine Corps hadn't stolen enough ships to create a Navy. The nation never bought or never built ships for the Navy. What they did was they commissioned ships that were used for merchants, and they basically said, okay, we're going to rent your ship, and we'll pay for it if it gets destroyed. We're going to put Marines on it, and we're going to go steal ships, and those ships will become our ships. That's how rudimentary this stuff was. And so it took time to actually say we need to focus on the Navy as a nation, because it wasn't until Adams where he actually started doing coastal defenses like a Coast Guard as well as a Navy, because Adams being more of a Boston Harbor kind of Navy. I mean, he wasn't an Army guy. He wasn't brought up in the Army, but he did understand the importance of the strategic need for having this defense by the Navy. And in so doing, he was being criticized by his vice president, saying, you're wasting money. You're spending money we shouldn't be spending on a Navy. And then when he ousts Adams and becomes president, we're talking about Thomas Jefferson, the first thing he does practically is sends out Marines into the Ottoman Empire to basically combat the Barbary pirates in Tripoli, take back the ship, take back the goods, and take back the people. So, I mean, he used that Navy, but had Adams not done what he was doing, Jefferson would not have been responding. So, it's kind of... As a nation is trying to crawl, what do you focus on? And I give Washington credit because he knew we couldn't be picking fights out on the seas. But he should have also known we need to be prepared because those fights are coming. They're going to be knocking on our door eventually. And they did. We're going to be challenged. And as a matter of fact, in 1812, we were attacked by Britain. And they cleaned our clock because at that point we still didn't have a serious Navy. Why? Because all the focus was on the ground forces, the cavalry, and what they were doing all on land. So it's not that we didn't have some coastal defenses, it was just inept to basically combat the world empire, who had lots of ships, and they broke through, you know, our defenses and actually burned down D.C. to just show us how silly we are thinking we can protect ourselves. The problem was the British were silly in thinking that they could exert physically their control over us over such a vast ocean. They couldn't project power to the point where they could truly occupy and control us. And they had to learn that lesson again in the War of 1812. So let's pick it up from where you left off.
When the members compare and communicate to one another their knowledge of their respective districts and states, their collective intelligence will sufficiently enable them to perform the objects of their cognizance. They cannot extend their influence or agency to any objects but those of a general nature. The representatives will, therefore, be sufficiently acquainted with the interests of their states, although chosen by large districts. As long as the people remain virtuous and uncorrupted, so long as we may fairly conclude, will their representatives, even at their present number, guard their interests and discharge their duty with fidelity and zeal. When they become otherwise, no government can possibly secure their freedom.
Okay, so he kind of talks about the importance of the representatives keeping in mind the people. Because if they're going off and doing, you know, misuse of war, what have you, then they're going to get replaced. So that was a check that the people had on their representation. That, you know, they're not obligated. This is not a royal class. You know, at the end of your term, you're to be judged based on your performance. The problem is we stopped doing that a long time ago. Well, as long as he's Republican, I guess, you know, there's nothing we can do. And that's, see, that just points to how the party controls the big part of the problem. So now we go down to the next day, and Mr. Pendleton, and I have this as a note, and I apologize, folks, for you're going to see these notes. These are noteworthy comments that I'm highlighting, but I'm not really telling you what's in here. And so I apologize. But the very first note that we find, and it's on page 21, is right here. So go ahead.
Okay. But it is represented to be a consolidated government, annihilating that of the states. A consolidated government, which so extensive a territory as the United States, could not admit of without terminating in despotism. If this be such a government, I will confess with my worthy friend that it is inadmissible over such a territory as this country. Let us consider whether it be such a government or not. I should understand a consolidated government to be that which should have the sole and exclusive power, legislative, executive, and judicial, without any limitation. Is this such a government?
Okay, so hold on here. So what he's doing is he's basically laying out, because one of the arguments that came out of the Anti-Federalist was basically citing Montesquieu. You've got a republic, and a republic can't be controlled in a large scheme. They're looking at a republic where that government controls everything. And the point is that the republican form of government that the federal government as a general government is, it is limited. It only has these very specific powers. And that's what he's really going to be going through here, to prove that this is not a national government. This is not a one-stop-all where they have all of these things. Like he says here, I will confess with my worthy friend that is inadmissible over such a territory as this country. Let us consider whether it be such a government or not. I should understand a consolidated government to be that which should have the sole exclusive power of legislative, executive, and judicial without limitation. They're not creating a national government. They're creating a limited and defined general government. So anyway, let's go ahead.
Is this such a government, or can it be changed to such one? It only extends to the general purposes of the Union. It does not intermeddle with the local particular affairs of the states. Can Congress legislate for the state of Virginia? Can they make a law altering the form of transferring property or the rule of descent in Virginia? In one word, can they make a single law for the individual exclusive purpose of any one state? It is the interest of the federal to preserve the state governments. Upon the latter, the existence of the former depends. The Senate derives its existence immediately from the state legislatures, and the representatives and president are elected under their direction and control. They also preserve order among the citizens of their respective states, and without order and peace, no society can possibly exist.
All right, keep going.
Unless, therefore, there be state legislatures to continue the existence of Congress and preserve order and peace among the inhabitants, this general government, which gentlemen suppose will annihilate state governments, must be itself destroyed. When, therefore, the federal government is, in so many respects, so absolutely dependent on the state governments, I wonder how any gentleman reflecting on the subject could have conceived an idea of a possibility of the former destroying the latter. But the power of laying direct taxes is objected to. Governments must be supported. This cannot be done without a revenue. If a sufficient revenue be not otherwise raised, recurrence must be had to direct taxation. Gentlemen admit this, but insist on the propriety of first applying to the state legislatures.
Okay, so again, these are common arguments, like this argument against direct tax. Well, they should just be able to give us requisitions and we'll take care of them. No, that never happened, because that's how it was in the Articles of Confederation. The states basically turned their backs on them. They have to have the power and consequences of saying, you got to give us this money or we're going to come take it, because you've hired us, you've created us to do these very specific things. The importance is we keep them only doing those things and not allowing them to muddle and get into other things and start wandering around doing things they have no business doing. Okay, so let's keep going. There, go ahead.
Okay. Let us consider the consequence that would result from this. In the first place, time would be lost by it. Congress would make requisitions in December. Our legislature do not meet till October. Here would be a considerable loss of time, admitting the requisitions to be fully complied with. But suppose the requisitions to be refused. Would it not be dangerous to send a collector to collect the congressional taxes after the state legislature had absolutely refused to comply with the demands of Congress? Would not resistance to collectors be the probable consequence? Would not this resistance terminate in confusion and dissolution of the Union? The concurrent power of two different bodies laying direct taxes is objected to. These taxes are for two different purposes and cannot interfere with one another. I can see no danger resulting from this, and we must suppose that a very small sum, more than the impost, would be sufficient. But the representation is supposed too small. I confess, I think with the gentleman who opened the debate, Mr. Nicholas, on this subject, and I think he gave a very satisfactory answer to this objection when he observed that though the number might be insufficient to convey information of necessary local interest to the state legislature, yet it was sufficient for the federal legislature, who are to act only on general subjects in which this state is concerned in common with other states. The apportionment of representation and taxation by the same scale is just. It removes the objection that while Virginia paid 1/6 part of the expense of the Union, she had no more weight in public councils than Delaware, which paid but a very small portion. By this just apportionment, she is put on a footing with the small states in point of representation and influence in councils. I cannot imagine a more judicious principle than is here fixed by the Constitution.
Okay,
the number
so you
shall not exceed
I'm
one
sorry.
For every 30,000.
Okay, so you see what he just said there? That Virginia was paying for 1/6 of the needs of the federal government or this general government. And so if they were at full equal footing with the other states, then that's a problem. But under this new constitution, they wouldn't have equal footing in the House of Representatives. They would have equal footing only in the Senate on those matters at the state legislature. But those matters that interest the people at large, then they should have more weight. That's why, and the whole design of this. So that's why he's going into the 30,000. So here we go. This is the good part.
But if it is objected that the number may be less, if Virginia sends in that proportion, I ask, where is the power in Congress to reject them? States might incline to send too many. They are therefore restrained. But can it be doubted that they will send the number they are entitled to? We may be therefore sure from this principle unequivocally fixed in the Constitution that the number of our representatives will be in proportion to the increase or decrease of our population. I can truly say that I am of no party nor actuated by any influence, but the true interest and real happiness of those whom I represent, and my age and situation, I trust, will sufficiently demonstrate the truth of this assertion. I cannot conclude without adding that I am perfectly satisfied with this part of the system.
Okay, so questions? I mean, I think it's pretty clear. He was really laying out how this apportionment was both for tax purposes as well as representation. Remember, should one group have better advantage because they have less people in their state, but they have equal representation over the tax? So the concept of taxation without representation or representation with taxation, it should be equalized. And so the apportionment of the House of Representatives is how it was based, because Virginia should pay more because there's more people in it. But they should also have a bigger seat in the House of Representatives to be able to, you know, ensure their interests. the check on that is in the Senate, where all of the states have equal suffrage, equal representation. That's where everything is equalized between the representatives, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. So now, Mr. Henry goes down in some arguments and positions regarding the militia that I only bring up. These are anti-federalist positions that he's making assertions. So let's take a look at what he says and what does it mean. Go ahead.
Okay. My great objection to this government is that it does not leave us the means of defending our rights or of waging war against tyrants. It is urged by some gentlemen that this new plan will bring us an acquisition of strength, an army, and the militia of the states. This is an idea extremely ridiculous. Gentlemen cannot be earnest. This acquisition will trample on our fallen liberty. Let my beloved Americans guard against that fatal lethargy that has pervaded the universe. Have we the means of resisting disciplined armies when our only defense, the militia, is put into the hands of Congress?
Actually, it's not put into the hands of Congress unless there is a reason to call them. Now, he's only making these positions, but what is he really saying that's the problem with the Constitution, other than an ambiguous assertion that they're going to actually, you know, violate this? Okay, hold on here. If they violate it, then they can be held accountable. And we found already in the Massachusetts debates, it doesn't matter. You know, you can have the best of people. If they violate, they violate. We have to hold them accountable. It doesn't matter what law you give. Every law can be broken. What's important is, do we have a mechanism of enforcing and holding them accountable? That's the that right there is the magical potion. It's not whether they're going to violate. We have to assume that everything's going to be, they're going to try to violate anything and everything they can get away with. Mm-hmm. When we start holding them accountable, everything changes. Okay. So what's his next comment? Let's go for this.
Let me here call your attention to that part which gives the Congress power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for their and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. But this, sir, you see, that their control over our last and best defense is unlimited. If they neglect or refuse to discipline or arm our militia, they will be useless. The states can do neither, this power being exclusively given to Congress.
Okay, he's right. This is what I said earlier, that they have the responsibility of arming, they have the responsibility of organizing and disciplining. They pay for it. But as he also says, they're reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training. So in other words, the federal government funds it, but the states have to actually carry it out. They have to follow Congress's standards. So the question is, if Congress doesn't feed the militia, then what federal army are they going to have? If they starve the militia and the states actually can't defend themselves, how is the Union going to be defended? It can't. They don't have the ability to just create an army. The Constitution did not give them the ability, like the Navy, to just basically create an army. They must be called forth as the militia. That is the creation of the army, and it can only be funded by 2 years periods. There's no language anywhere in the ratification debates that calls and talks about bypassing the militia so that the army, the United States Army, can be basically created without using a militia. This helps you understand today that our U.S. Army is not a legitimate army in line with the Constitution. It has to be literally fed by this process that Patrick Henry points out. So what he's talking about is a direct violation of the Constitution. If we can't defend ourselves, then that's a problem, because they're not doing what they're supposed to. They're not equipping, training, or they're not paying for the equipping, training, and disciplining. The states have the responsibility of doing all of that, but the federal government has to pay for it. So if they don't pay for it and the states can't do it, then the states can't defend themselves. And then the federal government doesn't have the mechanism unless they violate the Constitution again in another way by creating a standing army that they don't have the authority to do. See my point?
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing in these anti-federalist arguments is they're making arguments of problems that will occur when the federal government violates the Constitution. Well, how is that relevant? Are you arguing that we need to comply to the Constitution? Absolutely. Then why don't you just say so? They're trying to twist it so it seems like the Constitution is actually the problem, when it's not. They're not proving the Constitution is the problem. They're just pointing out how the Constitution can be violated. And they're very good at twisting it. Let's go to the next one. And this is where Governor Randolph starts actually talking about currency. This is June 6th, and we're going to have a lot of dialogue here because this is when Madison, I think, is feeling a little better and actually takes the floor here a few times. Go ahead.
All right. I have before hinted at some other causes of quarrel between the other states and us, particularly the hatred that would be generated by commercial competitions. I will only add on that subject that the controversies may arise concerning the fisheries, which may terminate in wars. Paper money may also be an additional source of disputes. Rhode Island has been in one continued train of opposition to national duties and integrity. They have defrauded their creditors by their paper money. Other states have also had emissions of paper money to ruin of credit and commerce. To the ruin of credit and commerce. May not Virginia at a future day also recur to the same expedient? Has Virginia no affection for paper money or disposition to violate contracts? I fear she is as fond of these measures as most other states in the Union. The inhabitants of the adjacent states would be affected by the depreciation of paper money, which would assuredly produce a dispute with those states. This danger is taken away by the present Constitution as it provides that no state shall emit bills of credit.
Okay. All right. So we're just touching on currency. They're going to get into this in good detail. They're going to expose other states and even themselves. But the point is that paper money by itself, not tied to a species. In other words, our real currency is gold and silver. You can create paper that's commutable, that is actually a one for one. In other words, if you have one 20-ounce, you know, if 1 ounce of gold is worth $20 in a commutable bill, or 20 silver dollars, then you can still get a $20 1 ounce gold. It's commutable. You take those bills into a bank, and they will give you the gold if you want to have the gold in hand. Now, we're running out of time. So what we'll do is when we pick up tomorrow, we're going to dive into some other comments of Governor Randolph. And then Madison is going to begin his orations and clarifying and clearing the air of what Mr. Henry has already started stirring up. So, folks, I hope you enjoy this. This is my favorite ratification debate, and I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.